the point that I'd emphasize, I think we've been around the table, is that this is a picture that clearly doesn't mirror where we're at now.
Lawmakers accuse the governor of using fuzzy math with the budget forecast. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 21st of February. Good evening, I'm Annie Feit. Also tonight, Keegan Randall wins another World Cup race.
It was a long one, so I just focused on staying relaxed. And then with about 50 meters to go, I was able to find another gear.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Lawmakers have become skeptical of some of the data they're getting from the Parnell administration about the future of the state's economy. Governor Parnell wants the legislature to approve tax cuts for the oil industry, but lawmakers say the administration is justifying those cuts with unrealistic budget forecasts. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The House Finance Committee last week began an overview of the Department of Revenue's long-term income projections for the state. The numbers presented by Commissioner Brian Butcher showed as much as $1.5 billion in excess money available for state operations even 5 years from now. The skepticism surfaced when Butcher presented a projection of future spending that the state would need to meet to get to that point. But the chart he presented, provided by the Office of Management and Budget, showed a 3% growth in the governor's budget from now until 2020. Lawmakers thought that's unrealistic. North Pole Republican Tammy Wilson began to question the information she was getting, and Butcher replied.
When's the last time that you remember that the budget from 1 year to the next only grew by 3%?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe there were some years in the late 90s, early 2000s that occurred.
Dillingham Democrat Bryce Edgman, a member of the majority caucus, said budgets back in the 90s were not like the budgets that lawmakers have seen in recent years.
That's yesterday. Today, it's, 10%, 11% the last year in the operating budget? It's increased. The point that I'd emphasize, I think we've been around the table, is that this is a picture that clearly doesn't mirror where we're at now.
Butcher reminded members that the chart came from the Office of Management and Budget. But Anchorage Democrat Mike Dugan would not leave that alone.
I'm afraid you're going to have to listen to what we have to say about this. It is your slide. I do think it's misleading. I would appreciate it if it never shows up again or only shows up again when there was actual support for the information that it contains.
Even the committee's co-chair showed dissatisfaction, not with Butcher himself, but with the information. Haines Republican Bill Thomas said the budget started this session showing a nearly 5% increase in spending, not the estimated 3%. And he reminded members that their own credibility is on the line.
When we already have a number that's presented us beyond the 3%, and then to go home and people say, well, geez, you blew it out of proportion. We didn't do anything. We're just trying to keep the people in jail and courts moving.
More challenges came up when Butcher gave departmental estimates of the amount of oil expected to be produced. After comments by Kotzebue Democrat Reggie Jewell, the commissioner agreed there have been some errors in previous projections.
Somebody's been feeding us a line somewhere.
I wish I could speak to the prior years. Unfortunately, I'm kind of limited to the information I have right now. I mean, I wasn't sitting in front of the committee talking about a certain percent. This is just what we have based on historical and based on the book that came out, you know, 2 or 3 months ago.
Dillingham's Edgman made the connection between the current budget consideration and the reliability of information when the committee gets to the governor's bill cutting oil taxes. He noticed, while price estimates are not within the state's control, the administration seems to have a lot to say in predicting future production.
On the production side, there's discretion that can be applied administration to administration to serve whatever goals that administration may have.
A tax bill is not yet before the Finance Committee, but members have given the administration a warning. They need reliable data to justify cutting revenue. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A state lawmaker is making her way back to the state capitol in Juneau after refusing a pat-down search at the Seattle airport. Representative Sharon Cisna underwent a body scan as she was preparing to leave Seattle-Tacoma International Airport yesterday and was then required to undergo the pat-down by Transportation Safety Administration officials. Her chief of staff, Michelle Scannell, said the TSA called for the pat-down because the scan showed Cisna had had a mastectomy. The TSA, on its website, says security officers need to see and touch prosthetic devices as part of the screening process. Both full-body scanners and pat-down searches have become under increasing criticism as the TSA has stepped up its airport security measures. The Association of Village Council Presidents wants a new road connecting the Yukon and Kuskokwim Rivers. AVCP is a nonprofit Native association representing 56 tribes in the YK Delta, and they say the road could bring cheaper energy to the region. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The 40-mile road would run from Kalskag to near Russian Mission.
That's the closest part from the Kuskokwim River to the Yukon.
Mike Hoffman is AVCP Executive Vice President.
And it's been traveled for hundreds of years, probably thousands of years.
According to Hoffman, Russian explorers were using that route in the 1800s. A tram was built in the 40s and 50s, and for decades, people used it to move their boats from waterway to waterway. The tram has become dilapidated, but people still use it from time to time. Starting in 1980, AVCP started looking at building a road instead of the tram. The project never panned out, although studies were done. Then recently, Kalskag asked AVCP to revisit the idea. Hoffman is on the Denali Commission's Transportation Committee, and he brought the road idea to their attention. The commission allocated $100,000 for another feasibility study, and AVCP matched it with another $100,000. The study started a few years back, but AVCP is still waiting to get those results. Hoffman says there's a lot of red tape, but they have high hopes for what a road like this could mean for YK Delta residents.
If it is feasible, which I believe it is, we have had people speaking with in meetings with ARCO and BP up in Fairbanks a couple of years back that if our gas line ever gets ready and gets into production, they have mentioned that if that road is in place, they might be able to put a bullet line across there and be able to bring propane down to the Kuskokwim region at, we're paying, over $2 a gallon for propane. We would get it just around between 50 cents and a dollar.
He says the road would greatly reduce the dependency on fuel that's being barged in at high prices.
We have to rely on Seattle, Oregon, Dutch Harbor. Our fuel, we have to rely on that. It would be nice to have another part of it, something somewhere else we could go make this competitive.
The road would also be more efficient than another option that many politicians have touted, especially during election time, and that's using the Yukon River to transport fuel to the west. That's when a gas line gets built. That option would still require barging down the Yukon River and then back up the Kuskokwim. Hoffman says the proposed road would be a much shorter route.
It could be propane, it could be gasoline, it could be wood, it could be wood. It could be making things a little more accessible to the Kuskokwim rather than having to go all the way down to the Yukon and all the way around to the Kuskokwim.
Hoffman says back when the road was first proposed in 1980, there were some concerns about the road connecting urban and rural Alaska. But he says times are changing.
With the price of fuel, the price of electricity, price of the cost of energy, now people are more receptive to maybe opening up sections like this.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Quest Mushers reflect on a challenging race.
I will never wish for bad weather ever again. I learned my lesson on that one.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Keegan Randall is celebrating another World Cup victory. The Anchorage skier won the World Cup skate sprint yesterday in Drammen, Norway. It's her second World Cup win this season and the third of her career. She's now leading the World Cup standings heading into the World Championships later this week in Oslo, Norway. Randall says she was reminiscing recently about her first World Championships 10 years ago.
Back then, a top 30 was an exciting result. So to be in a position now to take home some medals is just a great testament to what we've believed in and worked hard together on. So I would love to put down a good result and win a medal for the team, as, you know, more than myself, because it's really cool to see how it lights everybody up and is, like I said, a great reward for everything we've done.
Randall spent the last month training in Anchorage, a welcome break from racing in Europe. She says it gave her a chance to sleep in her own bed, reconnect with friends, and recharge. It's a strategy that worked well for her leading up to last year's Olympics in Vancouver, Canada. The victory in Drammen confirmed it was time well spent. Randall is looking forward to this week's competition. She says skiing in the World Championships in a country like Norway is a little like competing in the Super Bowl in the United States.
I think that kind of energy, that many people just excited about sport and competition and, you know, my sport, my passion, it's going to be just incredible to take it in. And I have to say, you know, when I'm focused on racing and stuff, I don't necessarily hear it, but for sure just the atmosphere is going to keep me really positive and excited. And then when I cross the finish line, then it'll all come rushing in. It'll sound pretty good.
The World Championship sprint takes place on Thursday. Randall is planning on competing in four other events, including the team sprint, the 10-kilometer classic, and the 30K skate. The Yukon Quest wrapped up over the weekend as the final musher came in and the race awards banquet was held. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
This year's Yukon Quest was dominated by extreme weather. Champion and Rookie of the Year Dallas Seavey says he's lucky, but that he's also very excited to have finally won a sled dog race after mushing his whole life.
Happy how things turned out placement-wise. You know, like I've said, our more conservative early schedule that was really based around training than an Iditarod team turned into an ideal racing schedule with these adverse conditions.
Second-place finisher Sebastian Schnula usually hopes for bad weather because he says it's what makes him competitive. But at the banquet, he said his attitude may have changed.
I will never wish for bad weather ever again. I learned my lesson on that one.
Most of the mushers at the finish banquet shared Schnula's opinion, including third-place finisher Ken Anderson.
It's going to take some memory loss to want to do it that the same way. But I learned a lot.
Some of the more candid words came from Toke musher Hugh Neff, who led the race until a windstorm on Eagle Summit ended his run. He says he will first and foremost always be a Quest musher, but he also says the race itself may have to change.
Oh, I'll do this race for the rest of my life. I just don't know if I'll ever come this way because I don't really believe in making dogs go over Eagle Summit like this. I don't think it's right. The Quest wants to think it's the toughest race in the world, and Maybe being tough is being stupid, and it's a wake-up call for all of us to make this as safe a race as possible, as well as a challenging race, but it should be as safe, and I think the people in charge really need to make an extra effort to do their best to enable that mushers and dogs can make it safely down the trail.
Neff lost a dog during his ordeal on Eagle Summit. He says money donated to his kennel from the National Education Association of Alaska will go towards animal care at both the Fairbanks and Whitehorse animal shelters. The Veterinarian's Choice Award, given for the most outstanding dog care this year, was presented to Mike Ellis and his wife Sue. Ellis says he works hard to make sure his purebred Siberian Huskies are healthy and happy.
I think my dog care is getting better. I really always strive to do better tomorrow than I did yesterday.
Race marshal Hans Utley had no difficulty presenting Wasilla musher Kelly Griffin with the Challenge of the North Award. Griffin says she can't imagine living any other way than by the code of the North.
You have to, yeah. And I like to, yeah, because it's what goes around, comes around, and all that good stuff. And yeah, it's just it's a natural thing, isn't it? You don't even think about it. It's the way things are.
A new award was given at this year's banquet, the Silver Legacy Award, in honor of Brent Sass's leader, Silver, who has led at least four teams to safety during his career. Sass was presented with a portrait, and Silver was given a steak dinner and a giant bowl filled with dog treats. Sass calls Silver the heart and soul of his kennel.
It was a great run. Silver has been amazing for his fifth Quest, and that's been one of the highlights for sure, seeing him just thrive once again.
The evening ended with the arrival of Canadian musher Hank DeBrune and his nine Siberian Huskies, who crossed the finish line in time to claim the Red Lantern from race director Marty Stewart.
Congratulations.
I'll tell you guys, I hid in the bush for 2 days just to be last, eh?
25 mushers left Whitehorse and headed for Fairbanks this year. Nearly 2 weeks later, grueling trail conditions had tested even the toughest mushers, and only 13 teams crossed the finish line in this, the 28th annual Yukon Quest. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The job of a fisherman has a reputation for being deadly, but it's a painful career, too. Now the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health is trying to change that by studying injuries suffered by fishermen. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health has long had a system for monitoring fatalities in the fishing industry. But in recent years, the Institute has also been working to figure out what the most common injuries experienced by fishermen are and how they're caused. The ultimate goal is to determine which practices can prevent these accidents from happening. And to do this, NIOSH has been reviewing records from Unalaska's local clinic. Jennifer Lincoln is an injury epidemiologist at the NIOSH Alaska Field Station, and she's leading this effort. She explains why examining injuries reported to Illaloo Family and Health Services made sense for the project.
The next logical thing to look at if you want to prevent people from hurting themselves are things that don't result in a fatality. But there's not a single place to go for that kind of information. And during one of my reviews of one of my research programs, somebody from industry suggested that I go to the health clinic and look at the records.
Lincoln is focusing on injuries reported over a two-year period. The data she looks at is scrubbed of any personal information, but it often contains the vessel or company name, which allows NIOSH to study injuries by gear type. The record review began last spring, and Lincoln traveled to Unalaska this past week to visit the clinic and share her preliminary results. Lincoln says that hand injuries experienced during offloads are especially common among fishermen. She adds that this type of research often leads to new innovations that can improve vessel safety down the road.
Sometimes people will get their rain gear or their glove or something entangled, and they're pulled towards the winch, and so pulled away from the controls that operate it. So retrofitting the e-stop allows you to hit it and mm-hmm. stop it from moving. So that's mm-hmm. something that we had the surveillance data showing that there were entanglements. We worked with fishermen to come up with a solution, and then we were able to design this engineering solution, and now we've licensed it to a company to market it.
Lincoln says that NIOSH's next step is producing a draft report. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Cross-border power line advocates are excited by prospects of an expanded British Columbia electrical grid. Alaska-Canada Energy Coalition members say the project, under discussion for years, could help boost the region's economy. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
North America's mainland power grid is about to get a lot closer to Southeast Alaska. That's the word from advocates of a new electrical line through the mountains separating the region from British Columbia. Gordon Loverin is part of the effort to build BC Hydro's 215-mile-long Northwest Transmission Line. It would extend the grid north to a point about 100 miles east of Wrangell. Loverin told a meeting of the Alaska-Canada Energy Coalition that the project has just undergone an extensive environmental assessment. He expects formal approval soon.
I'm of the opinion that we haven't heard yet about the announcement because there's a leadership race for the Liberal Party, which is the governing party in British Columbia right now. And I suspect that they're going to leave the announcement of the Northwest Transmission Line to the new premier, whomever that may be.
The line could link new British Columbia hydropower plants and mines. Loverin, a Tahltan First Nations leader who is also Tlingit, says he and other advocates will push to expand the grid further north and west.
I believe we have the membership in place with the right connections both in Alaska and in Yukon to be able to begin these discussions and move forward in creating a northern grid system, which is definite social and economic benefits for the region as a whole.
That was music to the ears of those attending this month's ACE Coalition Conference in Juneau. The group wants construction of a line from the Tai Lake Hydro Project east of Wrangell across the mountains to a new BC power line. Members also backed new Southeast Alaska hydro developments, including controversial private projects in Thomas Bay, north of Petersburg, that would feed into the line. Conference organizer Paul Southland says the group also backs expansion of the region's grid so villages can gain access to low-cost power.
We're starting an industry for the entirety of Southeast Alaska and Alaska. We're just a beta project. Everybody else gets to join in. I don't want anybody to get under the misconception that if we get ours, nobody else gets theirs.
If built, BC's Northwest Transmission Line would still be about 80 miles from the Tai plant. Southland says a Canadian developer is looking at constructing the connection to the border, leaving only about 25 miles in Alaska. The most recent study showed the cost at about $30 million, and he says that might be privately funded. Energy Coalition members say they hope to increase support by publicizing potential job impacts. Jeff Leahy of the National Hydropower Association told the conference about a recent employment study. He says Alaska's development potential could lead to construction, maintenance, and operational jobs.
You need everything from electrical engineers, civil engineers, operations managers, plant managers, construction jobs, technical jobs, fisheries biologists, people to do the environmental studying. And these are good paying, family supporting jobs.
But they don't come cheap. Dams, lake taps, turbines, and power lines cost tens of millions of dollars. And while public financing is a major part of most Alaska projects, funders are more focused on construction within the state than crossing any borders. ACE Coalition members say they'll still lobby for support, maybe trying to tap into federal clean energy initiatives. The Wrangell-based group includes mine developers, power companies, community leaders, and Native corporations. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
State officials issued no charges to a hunter that killed an Alaskan black bear on national television. The incident was part of a Discovery Channel reality show episode that aired recently, inspiring a flood of complaints to Alaska state troopers and wildlife biologists. Tara Bicknell has more from Haines, where the television show was filmed last summer.
Greg Remsburg's 10-year-old son, Brandon, has just seen a grizzly bear.
He's right in our deal.
Calls and emails came in from all over the country after television viewers tuned into the Discovery Channel's Gold Rush Alaska series and watched as one of the reality show miners shot and killed a black bear outside of Haines.
It's the first bear that's come into camp in broad daylight. And it's just yards from where they are eating breakfast. Their safety is now under threat.
Ryan Scott, Fish and Game Area Management Biologist for the region, said there was enough concern to begin an investigation on the legality of the shooting.
It started as questions about the harvest of a bear that was depicted on the TV show, the Gold Rush show. I mean, everything kind of ran the gamut from people who didn't agree with hunting or harvesting animals to they had questions about what they were seeing on the show and the process in taking the animal.
You know, the issue that was brought to light with us was people thought the bear had been illegally shot.
Rick Merritt is the state wildlife trooper in Haines.
Possibly two reasons. One, because, you know, some folks took it as a defense of life and property shooting. And then the other issue was with him being a non-resident from Oregon, did he have the correct license and tags?
They together determined that although the killing was not in defense of life or property, as the show portrayed, the hunter did possess the proper paperwork and license to make it a legal bear harvest.
You know, what it came down to is the individual had the correct non-resident hunting license as well as a tag for a black bear.
But one inconsistency led some viewers to make that first phone call. In a recent letter to lead miner Todd Hoffman, geologist Bill Cole of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources wrote that the bear that entered camp shortly before the shooting was a brown bear, and the bear that was shot was a black bear. Again, Trooper Merritt.
There were two separate bears. The first bear in that first clip was a brown bear. The second bear was definitely a black bear. And they were in two complete separate areas. So a lot of that, what people had observed from watching the TV show, I think they perceived and thought it was the same bear.
State land use permits usually stipulate that mining camps are not to be used for recreational hunting, but by oversight, that was not included in the permit for the TV show miners. The letter indicated that stipulation will be included in any 2011 permit. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Annie Feit. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.